Welcome to Multifamily Real Estate Investing, presented by Mara Poling. My name is Pat Poling. I am the founder and CEO of Mara Poling, and I'm happy to be with you this week to talk about a topic that I think will be of value to those of you that are passive investors, as well as those of you that are building your own portfolios. And that is designing with options. Real estate is inherently illiquid, but your investing doesn't have to be. There are ways to design investments so that you can mitigate the illiquidity in real estate and provide yourself with multiple options to exit and or extend your investment. And that's what we're going to chat about this week. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to email me, pat@marapoling.com, marapoling.com. And don't forget to swing by the Learning Center at marapoling.com for all the great content there. We had a wonderful session last week, one of our live webinars. If you have interest in participating in one of our future sessions, you can go to the Learning Center and click on webinars and register. Those of you that have registered will be receiving your copies this week of the recording of last week's session. So if you do register and aren't able to attend, you will get the recording and it will be available on the Multifamily Real Estate channel in a couple of weeks. All right, with that, let's get to this week's topic. Design with options. So what do I mean by that? Well, we all know that real estate is a great investment from a stability standpoint, that it generates equity growth and cash, that there's wonderful tax advantages. And if you were describing that to someone, they might say, well, what's the catch? Well, the catch is illiquidity. If you invest in real estate, you can't decide tomorrow that you want your money back. Or at least decide that you want your money back and get it all back and get it back quickly. So that's the price we pay for being real estate investors. But it doesn't have to be an all or nothing proposition. There are ways that investments can be designed to mitigate the illiquidity that's inherent in real estate. Now, if you're building your own portfolio and you're using residential recourse debt, right? So you went and bought a single family home or a condo and you just took out a loan from the bank, then some of these tools aren't necessarily going to apply. However, if you've invested in a piece of property that you purchased and you have commercial debt on it, more traditional non-recourse debt with a balloon at 5 years or 7 years or 10 years or something like that, then this will be right up your alley. And for all of you that are passive investors, this is exactly the way your investments can be structured by the sponsors that you're working with. Now, they may or may not choose to use all these tools. We do so because it's just not clear what the future holds. We're very confident about the long-term success of multifamily. We believe that multifamily performs throughout the entirety of the economic cycle. Whether cap rates are up or down, interest rates are down or up, whatever might be going on, we believe there's always opportunities to make additional quality investments and to exit investments and do so in a way which is a positive event for our investors. Having said that, because we don't know exactly what it's going to look like at any given point in time, we want to have options. And that's ultimately the best way to manage this issue around illiquidity. And so I'm going to talk to you about three specific areas that we use when we're designing an acquisition that provide us options over time. Now, before I do that, let's start with a non-option scenario so we know what we're comparing this to. So we could, right, Mara Poling, we could say we're going to go buy a piece of property and we're going to hold that asset for 5 years. We're going to do some value add improvements. then we're going to finish those improvements and let the property stabilize. And then we'll begin looking at an exit, maybe sometime in year four, early part of year five, and we'll move out of the asset. That could be the plan. And we could design everything to do exactly that. 5-year debt, a 2-year run cycle on improvements, a whole host of decisions, how we treat depreciation, all the rest of it, with this mindset towards we're out of here in late year four, early part of year five, no later than the end of year five. All right, so that's our baseline. So here's the three things we would suggest should be looked at when designing options into an acquisition. Number one, long-term debt, not 5-year debt. We utilize debt that is generally 10-year. Sometimes we'll do 12-year debt. And then look to have options in that debt structure that would allow us to exit earlier than 10 or 12 years. And here's what those options look like. So number one would be to sell via an assumption. If we had 10-year debt, we could sell an asset in year four, year four and a half, the early part of year five, and the purchaser could assume the debt that we have on the asset. Now, a couple things about that. If interest rates have moved in a moved downward since we took out that debt, then it may not be very attractive from an assumption standpoint. So that's a possibility. And we'll talk about other options here in a moment. If interest rates have moved alternatively higher, then the assumption actually has some incremental value to the transaction. And we've been on both sides of that fence. Now, when you sell an asset and they assume the loan, unless the asset has not grown in value since the original loan was taken out, and that might happen if, for example, I refinanced an asset, put new debt on it, and then sold it a year later. In that instance, then, it may not have moved a great deal. If it hasn't, then the loan to value of the assumption could be enough to make the deal work. In many instances, it's not, and the buyer would need to take out a second loan, a supplemental loan, to make up the difference between the loan to value of the assumption and the target loan to value that they're looking for to make their investment perform well. So assumptions can work. They don't always work. One of the nice things about selling via an assumption is whatever prepayment penalties, whether it's yield maintenance or defeasance, whatever's built into the loan, those don't begin. The loan is assumed. The loan's not paid off, so nobody owes the bank that extra money. So that can be very favorable for the seller as well as for the buyer. So an assumption is a very successful way to be able to exit an asset in which we can have longer-term debt, but now we've got the ability to leave whenever we want. We're not stuck with 5 years. Another way to do that would be for us to keep the asset a longer period of time. We might get to year four or year five and look around and say, we could exit right now. The assets that are available in the markets we want to invest in maybe don't check all of our boxes. So let's not exit. We'll just hang on to this. And we've got lazy equity we've built up in this asset. So what are we going to do about it? Are we just going to leave that lazy equity there, millions and millions of dollars, not doing anything? Well, no. We could take a supplemental loan out ourselves. If that original debt has a favorable interest rate on it, I might be willing to pay a higher supplemental rate so that my blended rate would be competitive or maybe even lower than what I would get if I paid the loan off completely. And if I did supplemental and pulled that cash out, I wouldn't have to pay the defeasance or yield maintenance because the first loan is not getting paid off. So I can still successfully get the lazy equity out of that deal and get it working without having to sell. And I could sell at any time that I wanted and just pay the defeasance. Let's say that we held the asset through year four, year five, and actually held it through year six and all the way out to year seven. And here we are in year seven and we have 10-year debt. Well, I can't sell it as an assumption anymore. There's not enough term left on it. And likewise, I wouldn't be able to put any supplemental debt on it at that point in time. So if I wanted to access the lazy equity that was there, I'd be looking at selling and I'd be paying yield maintenance or defeasance. And it would be smaller. It's smaller because the closer you get to the end of the term, the smaller that prepayment penalty becomes. It's also smaller because I had the option when I acquired the asset and put the original debt in place to structure the yield maintenance. If it was a 10-year debt, I could have put 9.5 years of yield maintenance on it, which would be sort of the standard starting point. I could have put 7 years of yield maintenance on it. I could have put a buy down on it where every year the yield maintenance decreased at an increasing rate such that by the time I get out near year five or year six, it's not a factor anymore. So all of those things we could have designed in from the beginning, again, to give us more options. And by that point in time, depending upon how the asset has performed, remember, we're underwriting conservatively. If the asset has performed well, we likely will be able to exit, achieve our return target, including paying the modest amount of defeasance or yield maintenance that would be due at that point in time. So by structuring longer-term debt, I, as you can see, now have the ability to exit at year three or four, all the way out to holding it through year 10 if I want, and almost anywhere in between. If I put 5-year debt on a property, I can't sell that to anybody as an assumption. There's not enough term left. I can't take a supplemental loan out on it. And I'm bound and determined now that I have to do something at year five. And I have to make a fairly substantial decision. Am I going to keep the asset, therefore refinance it, put brand new debt on it, go through that entire process and expense again, and then sell it 6 months later or a year later? Am I going to find myself in a position where I have a willing buyer that can pay the money that I want, but they can't close the deal for 6 months, but I need the refinancing done in 60 days. It's too risky in our mind to back ourselves into that corner. So that's why we like the longer term debt. This allows us to deal with the illiquidity issue by having multiple ways we can access that equity, either through a sale that we can do essentially almost at any point in time, or by accessing the lazy equity through some restructuring of debt. All right, so here's the next piece. So debt structure is one. Another way that we can design and do design options into deals is to underwrite for a long-term hold. So I might have a plan, and by the way, this is true for anyone that's investing with short-term holds in mind, right? So if you are investing with a sponsor on a transaction where the expectation is to exit in 24 to 30 months. It's going to be a purchase, a quick close, 12 intensive months of improvements, and then some stabilization before it goes back on the market. If that's the plan, then this can be done as well. And that is underwrite as though you're going to hold it for the entire 10 years. Which again coincides with the debt that we're suggesting. This does a couple of things. It allows you to model the time frame that you're targeting. We target generally around 5 years. So I can look at what the performance is like at 5 years and determine if that's going to be enough to make the investment worthwhile for myself and my investors. If I'm investing on a short-term basis, like I said, 24 to 30 months, I can do the same thing. I can look and see, how is this asset going to be performing at year two, two and a half, three, year three and a half? And based on that, make a decision as to whether or not this looks like a good investment. But underwriting longer term, and again, having longer term debt structured, underwriting longer term also allows me to say, what if I held it an extra year, an extra 2 years, an extra 3 years? What if I actually had to hold it 10 years? Now, we've not had that happen before. I'm not aware of any instances that come to mind where I know others that have had investments where they've, for some external reason, had to hold it 10 years. I know a lot of folks that have held assets 10 years or longer, much more a part of just their general strategy. But for those that, like us, are looking to invest, make value, grow the value of the asset, turn around, exit, and then reinvest those proceeds in another asset, 10 years is a long period of time. Underwriting for 10 years, though, allows us to sit back and be very confident that whatever is happening today, there's time to deal with it and address it over time. Nothing has to be rushed. If we do get to a place where an exit or a restructuring from a capital standpoint looks like it makes sense, but it just doesn't quite come together the way we would like, not a worry, because we still have a quality asset that's structured to perform well over 10 years. So underwriting for that entire time frame, and then evaluating each of those various windows. So for example, it might be, well, where's the time frame where we can first get to a place that the returns are sufficient that we'd be okay exiting? Now, obviously, that's an assumption that everything performs the way the underwrite is drafted. And we all know that that's not true. That's the one thing we know about underwrites, is that they're inaccurate. But we'll use them because that's the tool that we have. So it might be that, you know what, at between month 36 and month 42, so 3 years, 3.5 years, somewhere in that time frame, the asset, based on the forecast, will be at a place where we have made sufficient return such that we could exit. Okay, so that's the first window. We're satisfied with that. What's it look like at 5 years? Again, kind of the typical target we'd have. And then maybe 7 years. That'd be another window to look at. That 5 to 7 year window, we think, is a really a good sweet spot. Probably half of our assets have exited earlier than 5 years. I think off the top of my head that we've ever had anything actually that's extended beyond 5 years or much beyond 5 years. And we certainly haven't had anything over seven. But you'd want to look at 5 to 7, and then you'd want to look at 9 or 10. What's it like if we really did hold it this long period of time? And if we aren't seeing any issues arise by holding it longer, then we know that those become valid options. And therefore, the money that we've invested that is locked up inside this asset, we can now have plans to, again, access it through some of the debt structures we've talked about, which allow us to deal with this issue of illiquidity and give us flexibility about when we do decide to exit, as opposed to having a date more or less carved in stone from the get-go. All right, so the final piece is actually about the design of the exit. And every investment should be done in such a way that you make money when you buy, and you make money when you operate, and you make money when you sell. There is no, well, you make your money here. You make money throughout the entirety of the process. That's the way it should work. Good assets perform that way. And when you acquire an asset, when we acquire assets, certainly, part of that process is, well, what's the exit look like? And the exit has to be at those various timeframes. What would a 3 or 3.5 year exit look like? What about 5? What about 7? What about 9 or 10? What would the exit plan be at each of those? And our objective would be, in almost every instance, we would want to exit and execute a 1031, a sale exchange, so that we could defer the tax exposure from the profits we've made on that initial investment, roll that into a second generation asset that we then go through the exact same process again and grow it in value and so on and so on. So a 1031 would be our goal. And a 1031 may not be possible slash advisable slash easy at the given point in time that you ultimately get around to looking at actually exiting the asset. So let's say that we've got a target to exit between year five and year seven. Basically, once we've doubled our money, right? Maybe we make an investment with $5 million. When we would net $10 million, we want to get out. That's our plan. We want to double our money, and then we're going to get out, and then we're going to go do it again, and we'll then double the $10 million to $20 million and so on. Well, if we could do that by year five, that's a 20% total return. If we could do that by year seven, it's about a 14% return. Those are reasonable numbers. So somewhere between year five and year seven is a reasonable expectation that the investment could be doubled in value. And the plan would be, well, let's do that via a 1031. We get to that point in time. We're coming up on year five. The math says, yes, we're at that point. You know, maybe it's past year five. Maybe it's year five and a half coming into year six. But the math now says if we sold, we would walk away with $10.5 million or $11 million, and we invested five. Great. We've met our doubling number. Let's pull the trigger. But it's got to be a 1031. Otherwise, we're going to spend a chunk of that money we just made paying tax. And that's one of the reasons we invest in real estate, is because we can chain these 1031s together. And in doing so, pay the tax, but pay it years from now, maybe even decades from now, with dollars that are worth less than today dollars, and use those dollars for the entire time that we're deferring it, essentially an interest-free loan from the federal government. So that's our desired exit. What if when we get to that point and we've made our money, a 1031 doesn't look advisable? Maybe it's a scenario where the 1031 would be very complex. It's possible by that point in time that we've grown in value so much that we couldn't buy one asset that would really work. We need to split and buy two assets. Well, we've just made this four times as complicated because of what we need to do from this standpoint. What if what we were to find was at that point in time that we want to do this, the structure of the interest world, the debt world, has changed, and we couldn't get the same loan to value? Well, if we can't get the same loan to value, we could be looking at a boot exposure. Boot is the tax exposure on a 1031. We might be looking at a meaningful amount of boot exposure, and we don't want to just exit and double our money and pay tax. We want to double our money, exit, but defer the tax. And if we're going to have boot exposure, then maybe we wait a little while. So we want to have some flexibility for those reasons. But the strategy we then use is, well, if we're not going to exit right now, what would it look like if we held the asset for another 36 months? Can we grow the value of the asset? And if the answer is yes, then what we might look at doing is, of that $5 or $6 million of growth that we've experienced, that lazy equity, can we borrow $4 million of it out? Can we put a supplemental loan on it and pull that cash out and then put that cash to work so that it's growing and achieve one of the major objectives we have when we do use a 1031, and that is to free up lazy equity and get it working. So structuring assets with long-term debt, with lots of exit opportunities along the way, underwriting over that entire period of time with an evaluation of each of those major milestones, each of those major windows, to confirm that the asset doesn't just perform in one period, but performs throughout all of those periods such that they all are valid exit points. and then designing an exit that can be structured around a 1031, but that also has flexibility built into it and other strategies for accessing the lazy equity that's there. If you have your own portfolio and are using more traditional residential style debt, then underwriting for a longer term hold and refi options relative to a 1031, those are still applicable. If you are using commercial debt, or if you're a passive investor and are investing with a sponsor, these are some of the strategies that you may already see your sponsor using. If you work with us, these are absolutely the strategies you'll see us employing. I hope you found this week's session valuable. If you have any questions, shoot me an email, pat@marapoling.com, marapoling.com. And please join me next week for another episode of Multifamily Real Estate Investing, presented by Mara Poling.